It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Central Time, milk prices are at a six-year low. We'll find out how that's affecting Wisconsin dairy farmers. First, a major new development in the race for president today. Presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump named Indiana Governor Mike Pence as his running mate this morning. The announcement comes after Trump decided he would postpone announcing his running mate because of the terror attack in France. On Twitter today, Pence said that he was honored to join Donald Trump and work to make America great again. Here to tell us more about the announcement is Ben Schreckinger. He's a national political reporter at Politico. He's been covering the Trump campaign. Ben, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into the who here, let's talk about the when a little bit. Just before the convention, there's been a lot of rumbling, auditioning, things like that. But then maybe this postponement because of the attacks. So why did we end up finding out today after all?
My informed speculation is that Pence had to decide by noon today whether or not he was going to withdraw from the governor's race. So private assurances from Trump may have not been enough, given that so much coverage of this pick has noted that Trump is mercurial and that he is liable to change his mind at the last minute. I think that public assurance is what Pence needed to be able to, in good conscience, withdraw from the Indiana governor's race.
Now, you'd written about Governor Pence previous to this announcement. Tell us the basics. What would be on the back of his baseball card here?
He is a staunch conservative, both economically and socially. He served in the House of Representatives from 2001 to 2013, which is when he became the governor of Indiana, favored by the Koch brothers, favored by conservative movement stalwarts like Paul Ryan and the Club for Growth, and all around seen as the safe pick for Donald Trump.
Right, and people had been talking about Chris Christie or Newt Gingrich as the other shortlisters there, both outspoken, brash. I think neither of them would argue with that phrase. That's not Mike Pence. He's the one kid who doesn't fit in on that list.
That's right, Trump himself is more similar to Gingrich and Christie in that way, and so putting Pence on the ticket really provides a stylistic counterbalance and sort of provides assurances for some people who are worried that Trump is can be a loose cannon.
And also, there's been a lot of talk. Mike Pence, an early Tea Party member in Congress, social conservative. I think everybody agrees with that. This is something that might reassure social conservatives in the Republican Party who weren't quite sure if this New York billionaire was one of theirs.
That's right, especially on issues like abortion and same-sex marriage. Pence is much more clearly, much more consistently conservative than Trump has been. That being said, he fumbled a little bit last year in defending religious freedom law in Indiana, sort of ended up roughed up on both sides, but we just actually put up a story on our site about how evangelicals are a little upset with how Pence handled that, but nothing like their concerns about Trump, who has spoken out in years past strongly in favor of abortion rights, indicated support for gay marriage in the past, though now he says he's on the other side of those issues.
We're talking to Ben Schreckinger from Politico. You can read his work at politico.com. He's been covering the Trump campaign, looking at Donald Trump's running mate, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, now not seeking re-election as governor there, joining the Republican ticket, it looks like. Is this a guy that, Ben, that people are going to be excited about? Is this a running mate who's going to bring people to the polls, to the extent that running mates ever bring people to the polls?
Right, and that's a good caveat. It's not clear if running mates really do matter, if they can even carry their home states. And so that's not what this pick was about. Certainly, to the extent that running mates can do that, that's not really who Pence is. He's not an electrifying figure. He's not someone like Sarah Palin, who threatened to overshadow John McCain back in 2008. This is much more about the signal that it sends to elites in the Republican Party, and presumably in terms of what it says about how Trump wants to govern. He said that he wants to have someone on the ticket who has experience in Congress. That's something that Pence certainly does have.
You said this was a signal to elites in the Republican Party. So far, has that signal been received? What are we hearing from prominent Republicans about this choice as a running mate?
That signal has been received. The Club for Growth has praised the pick, obviously, or for those who aren't familiar, Club for Growth has been harshly critical of Trump's economic policies, and Trump, in turn, has been bashing the Club for Growth for months, so that's notable. Paul Ryan, who is sort of straddling a fence in terms of his public statements about support for Trump, and has been trying to feel more comfortable about supporting the standard bearer of his party, has long been known to be a fan of Mike Pence. He's praised the decision. The Koch brothers are big Mike Pence fans, and they obviously are no fans of Donald Trump. It's not expected that they're about to get off of the sidelines and support this ticket now that Pence is on it, but certainly they look more favorably upon the Trump campaign today than they did before this pick.
Mike Pence has criticized Donald Trump in some cases for particular positions. I think the Muslim ban, comments about a Mexican-American judge. Mike Pence has made immigration proposals that don't necessarily fit in with Donald Trump's, going back to his time in Congress, that is. Will Trump supporters be disappointed that this will somehow dilute the Donald Trump message?
You know, everything I know about Trump supporters makes me doubt that any running mate pick short of some sort of
Hillary Clinton or
Democrat,
something.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton, is gonna really disappoint them. Trump is such an overpowering personality that I don't think his supporters believe that Pence is really gonna pull him away from the positions that they like. It's probably gonna be really more just tough for Pence to adjust to being on a ticket with Trump, someone who, for example, wants to renegotiate trade deals, has been harshly critical of free trade. Pence is a big supporter of free trade. But I don't think many Trump supporters are going to be let down.
One milestone in Mike Pence's political career was when he wrote about and really made the case for positive campaigning, saying he regretted early career negative campaigns he had been involved in, thought a lot more could be gained by campaigning on a positive note, the happy warrior archetype, as people have called it in American political history. Is presidential election 2016 the place for somebody who wants to accentuate the positive?
It's gonna be really interesting to see how he handles that preference, whether he's able to stick to it. Trump, in separate interviews last week, first said that he wanted an attack dog and a vice president. A day later, he gave another interview, said, no, actually, that's not what I'm looking for. That is sort of the trope about running mates, that they serve as the attack dogs, the people who are willing to go negative. That's considered a little bit outdated at this point. There are plenty of surrogates on both sides who can play that role, which means it's less important for a VP to play it. And clearly, in the case of the Trump ticket, the man at the top of the ticket has had no compunction about being his own attack dog. So maybe Pence will be able to skate through and only be Mr. Bright and Sunny.
I've been seeing tweets from reporters at CNN and NBC, maybe elsewhere by now, saying inside sources in the Trump campaign say Trump was calling around late last night, seeing if maybe he still had time to back out on Mike Pence. Unconfirmed anonymous sources, I think. But do you think that says anything about the campaign, whether they're really sure about this guy?
Sure. So the campaign denies this. That being said, the damage in some sense is already done because it compounds this image of indecision around this pick. It leaked out yesterday that Pence would be the guy. The campaign kept saying that Trump hadn't made his mind up yet. The campaign then delayed the announcement, citing these terror attacks in Nice. But the thought in political circles that was that also Trump wanted the extra time or could have used the extra time. And when they postponed the announcement, they didn't give clear details about when the announcement would be made. So there's something about the rolling out of this VP pick that has been less than airtight. And of course, all of that speaks to what's been true about this campaign from the start, which is that it's not well organized. It's really a fly by the seat of your pants operation. And you saw some of that shine through in the way this went down.
We talked about Republican reaction to the choice. How about Democrats and other groups critical of Republicans and of the Trump campaign? Have we seen much targeting of this selection so far?
Yeah, and it's been basically, you know, by the book, Democratic attack on a conservative. He's such a cut and dry, such a standard issue, social and economic conservative, that you just see sort of a standard playbook here. They're saying that he's a Tea Partier, which he is. They're painting him as an extremist conservative. They're painting him as anti-LGBT, anti-choice. Sort of what you would have expected the standard playbook to be for the top of the ticket if it had been any Republican other than Trump that had won. So far, the only sort of thing that's really unique to Pence that stuck out is this frankly embarrassing op-ed he wrote in 1998 saying, no, smoking doesn't kill you, and sort of painting it as political and media hysteria. This was long after the scientific consensus was that smoking is a serious hazard to your health. So that's sort of the most interesting piece of oppo that surfaced about this guy so far.
I wanted to talk about the where here as well. This is a governor of Indiana, state that usually goes for Republicans in presidential campaigns. Used to be conventional wisdom, oh, you pick a running mate that's going to help you in a key state. Is that true anymore? Is this at all geographically based, this decision, do you think?
There's something to picking someone out of the Midwest. Obviously, Gingrich is from Georgia. It's a state that may be in play this year, but if it is, the Trump ticket has bigger issues to worry about. The geographic thing is a little outdated. That being said, Trump's appeal is in the Midwest. The consensus is that if they could have gotten Kasich on the ticket, they would have taken Kasich because Ohio is a much more crucial swing state than Indiana. Again, if Indiana is in play, or if it's looking like it's going to the Democrats, that would be very bad news for the Trump campaign. But yeah, there is something to this Midwest Rust Belt appeal that Pence has.
Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Ben Schreckinger, national political reporter at Politico. He joined us to talk about Donald Trump naming Indiana Governor Mike Pence as his running mate. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's Food Friday. We'll learn about how to entertain outdoors and what to cook for those outdoor gatherings. First, around 4:30 Central Time today, reports of military activity in the Turkish capital of Ankara and its most populous city, Istanbul, indicated a coup was underway in the country. The country's prime minister has gone on TV and announced that a portion of the military has made a coup attempt on the government of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Turkey has seen successful military takeovers before. Joining us now to tell us more about what this could mean for the country's future and for American foreign policy in the region, we have Saeed Khan with us. He's a lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University. Saeed, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, obviously this is underway, very confusing, a lot going on there. What do we know with confidence right now about what's going on?
Well, what we do know is what has been so far the reaction on the street in Istanbul, the country's largest city. It is on lockdown. The two major bridges which span the Bosphorus River, connecting Europe and Asia, are both closed. There are tanks which are rolling down the street. Martial law has been imposed. Curfews, gunfire has been heard, as well as military aircraft flying low over Istanbul, as well as in the nation's capital of Ankara. Now, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is actually on vacation in one of the coastal cities, and so he is not in the capital, nor is he in Istanbul. There is also a shutdown of social media, Twitter and Facebook, and that is why he's had to make a statement to the public using FaceTime and Skype. We also have come to know that flights out of Istanbul Airport have been either canceled or indefinitely delayed. So this is, for all intents and purposes, a military coup. But it's also important to recognize that this is not the first one that Turkey has had. This is probably the sixth coup in the last 56 years.
Yeah, since the time of Ataturk, the founder, in many ways, of modern Turkey, it seems like the military has seen itself as the guarantor of secular government and of, strangely enough, as it may seem, the constitution of Turkey. Can you talk about this, in some ways, self-appointed role of the Turkish military?
That's right. Mustafa Kemal, also known as Ataturk, the father of Turkey, had implemented various forms of reform, one of the major ones being in the area of secularism. Now, we don't know if that is the main plank that the military is trying to restore. President Erdogan has certainly moved over the last several years that he's been in power, moved Turkey into a more desecularized paradigm. But we find that after Ataturk's death in November of 1938, that the military has in fact then seen itself as the arbiter of Turkey, as well as the custodians of civilian forms of government. One of the things that's important to recognize is when there have been coups d'etat in Turkey, the military has really been reluctant to come in and impose martial law for any meaningful period of time. It has called for the dissolution of parliament as well as a declaration for new elections. So it's going to be interesting to see if, with the current situation, if a similar call will be implemented.
Now, how does the U.S. respond? How does do NATO allies of Turkey respond? On the one hand, it's likely a military government would work better in some ways with the United States and the interests in counterterrorism operations. On the other hand, this is an elected government. I don't think anybody questions the elections that brought Erdogan to power. What position does this put the United States government in particular in?
Well, for the United States, of course, they're watching this with a great level of trepidation. Turkey, as you said, is a NATO ally, has been so since the inception of NATO after World War II. The United States has Incirlik Air Force Base in Turkey, which is a very important strategic military installation. One of the things that we have found in the periods of political volatility with Turkey, as well as with its political stability, is that its relationship with NATO, as well as its relationship with the United States, has remained steadfast. Now, there have been certain declines in the level of cooperation. We saw one, for example, in 2003 when the Bush administration was trying to use Turkey as a point of access to northern Iraq during the Second Gulf War, and the Turkish parliament declined the offer or the request that was made. But we have not found that it has had a very deleterious impact on the relationship, and it's doubtful that this will cause any kind of a rupture. And as you rightly said, there is a possibility that there are those within the military establishment behind this coup who already have ties to the Pentagon and Washington more broadly.
Talking to Saeed Khan from Wayne State University about the ongoing coup in Turkey. Not completely clear what's happening now. The outcome, of course, still uncertain. Saeed, Turkey, a key part of what's going on in the war against the Islamic State movement in Syria, in Iraq. What could this do? This could really throw that effort into disarray.
Well, right now, the kind of fluidity of what Turkey has been doing may in fact be the cause of this coup. It's important to recognize that over the last 2 weeks, President Erdogan has had a significant change in tack of Turkey's relationship with several of its regional neighbors. Over the last week, it has sought to restore rather fractious relationships with Israel as well as with Russia. and more recently the revelation that there have been some back-channel conversations with the Assad regime suggesting that Turkey is retracting from its insistence that Assad must go, which of course is a very prominent talking point for the Obama administration. It seems as though that kind of change in tack may be behind the military acting as it has because of this unpredictability of exactly what Erdogan is doing, and the fact that he has over the last several years really consolidated power to create, ironically enough, almost Putin-like state is a cause for consternation for the military. And again, one of the reasons why they have probably devised that enough is enough.
Now, when we talk about they, it's not completely clear, I think, how much of the military is involved. If this is a faction, as the prime minister has said, to contemplate, I guess, the worst case scenario, could this tip Turkey into civil war? Could this be as bad as a Syria or an Iraq situation?
No, I think the idea of Turkey descending into Syria and or Iraq will not happen for a couple of reasons. First of all, Iraq and Syria had sectarian differences, which then were brought to the fore. Iraq being, of course, the situation between the Sunnis and the Shi'i, and similarly, in the case of Syria, a minority Alawite regime that was suppressing the Sunni majority there. Those demographics and those dynamics do not exist in Turkey. Turkey is still a very prosperous, economically, socially, and politically stable country. And it's also important to recognize that it was so even in the moments of political instability in its history. What we find here, though, is that there is inevitably going to be an economic impact. There's going to be a political impact, and factions are going to form. Those that are loyal to Erdogan, particularly those who like the trajectory that he has taken toward a less secularized climate, as well as economic prosperity. It's important to remember that in the first 10 years of his rule, Erdogan tripled the country's GDP. So there's a lot of people who are very invested in that. The kind of infrastructure development in Turkey is also quite high. At the same time, there are those people who feel as though he may have crossed the line toward becoming more of a megalomaniac and becoming too autocratic, especially when it comes to suppression of civil liberties, the threats to the journalism and social media sectors. So it's going to be interesting upon ideological grounds how this is going to play out. And again, if there is going to be new elections sooner rather than later, this is going to be played out at the ballot box instead of in the streets.
Saeed, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you.
That's Saeed Khan, lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University. He joins us to talk about the latest news of a military coup going on now in Turkey. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, it's our weekly roundup of news in Wisconsin, including the latest polling numbers in key elections. First, during the summer, we have longer daylight hours and more excuses to get outside. Maybe that stroll in the park, maybe you go on a long bike ride in the sunshine, and you can entertain outdoors. On this edition of Food Friday, we'll hear not only why entertaining outdoors is a great way to enjoy the weather, but also what you should serve to your guests. Joining us now is Anna Thomas Bates. She's a food writer for her website Tallgrass Kitchen and a contributor to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Anna, good to have you back.
Thank you.
Well, first, before we get to what to serve out there, why? Make the case that we should take advantage of this weather and have people over for a meal outside.
Yes, just have people over. I think everyone waits until conditions are perfect, until your house looks great, until your hair has grown out. Who knows? But really, just have people over. It is a beautiful time of year, and it's time for friends to have a great time and enjoy some relaxation and some beverages and some great food and get together.
Yeah, I have a gardening process I call shame weeding, basically where I find the spots in my yard that are the most shameful and pull it up. People are embarrassed maybe to have people over when the yard is a little out of control. You say, forget about it.
Yeah, I mean, think about when you go over to a friend's house. You don't think about, oh my goodness, the kids' toys are in the bathtub and their garden is overrun. You cut them some slack and
True.
People are going to do the same for you.
Well, I hope so. Well, you even write that entertaining outdoors is good for the soul.
I believe it is. I really believe being outdoors and being with good friends is more beneficial than probably eating a salad.
And we don't need to make a big production out of it. It can be something quick and easy, right?
Absolutely not. You could pick up things at your farmer's market or at the grocery store. You could even have it at a park if you don't want to have people in your yard. But there aren't a lot of great excuses. It can be as easy as you want it to be.
And a potluck is a good option.
Yes, then you really have to just make one thing, and everyone else brings something that they love as well.
Talking to Anna Thomas-Bates, food writer, a frequent guest here on Central Time. She's saying, hey, don't make a big production out of it. Just get out there and host people, have people over to eat outside. The summer is only so long here in Wisconsin. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you like to host outdoor meals, outdoor gatherings? Are they potlucks? Do you do all the cooking? What makes for great outside food? Or do you get people together at the park? The grill, is that involved in your outdoor entertaining, or is that just too much work while people are there? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Anna, let's talk about the kinds of foods to serve. Obviously, you want things that taste good with the smell of mosquito repellent, but what kind of things do you recommend for convenient, easy-to-prepare things?
You know, the easier, the better this time of year. No one, this isn't the time to pull out your roast rack of lamb because you want to be outdoors with your guests. So as you mentioned, the grill is a great option. You can certainly just do something as easy as brats and hot dogs, or you can do hamburgers or chicken or anything you want. I also really love to grill pizza. That's a really fun way, and your guests can get involved in making their own toppings as well.
And you suggested a recipe you put at people, and we've got this linked on the Central Time Facebook page, a berry bar. Talk us through this recipe.
Yeah, it's triple berry pie bars, and I found it on a website called Baker by Nature. And basically, it is kind of a crumbly pie crust that's on the bottom and the top, and then there's a sour cream, maple syrup, kind of a gooey layer, and then I used black cap raspberries and the last of the strawberries and blueberries from my yard, and it's delicious and rich and fruity, and it's a great potluck dessert.
Now, these berries are in season right now. Is this something that frozen berries would work with other times of the year?
You could, although frozen berries always stain a lot more, so they'll look different. They'll kind of be a solid purpley blue if you use frozen berries, but they certainly will still taste great.
So if you're pulling together your menu for a picnic or a backyard patio meal, what kind of things are going to be on it? Assuming it's not a potluck, it's all Anna all the time with the cooking, what's on your list?
You know, I would keep it pretty easy. I would start with some really beautiful, fresh local cheese, goat or sheep, something nice and creamy, or a ricotta. I would add fresh herbs and olive oil and put that out with a sliced baguette, probably some nice rosé or something sparkling. For the main meal, I would have something really simple from the grill, you know, just like some chicken thighs, baste it with some barbecue sauce at the end, and then a nice tomato salad and some other fresh things from the garden, and then definitely something with fruit for dessert. Either you could grill some peaches or do the triple berry pie bars or, you know, do a nice, like a berry crisp or a nectarine crisp.
Let's talk a little more about the grill, because I think there's two ways to approach it. One, hey, you've got people over. You don't want to be stuck at the grill. You want to be talking and mingling with people. Or you can be me and the people. You're an introvert. It's a little overwhelming. Oh, you guys just talk amongst yourselves. I'll be out checking the grill. Do you have a preference one way or the other, Anna?
You know, I usually, we're kind of stereotypical around here. Either my husband does it, or sometimes there's enterprising guests who prefer to do that as well. It's a talent of theirs, and like you said, maybe they're more comfortable there. But I also am good at multitasking, so I can flip over hot dogs or pizza dough while I'm chatting with guests as well. But, you know, you don't even have to do a whole meal. Now I live in the country, but when I lived in town, I would have a Friday night get-together that was a happy hour. It would be from 5 to 7 o'clock, so before dinner, I would serve one drink and one snack. People would just drop in. Kids would run around the backyard. We'd munch a little bit and kind of relax after the week, and then everyone would go to their separate ways to eat their meals.
Now, yeah, I could see myself doing that. So would you come up with a different appetizer or a different featured food each time you did that?
Yeah, I did. I kind of went with the season, so I'd do just a different punch or a batched cocktail or some sort of fun berry lemonade, and then yeah, just a little snack, maybe cheese stuffed in dates or jalapeno poppers or, you know, really anything.
Now, suppose you're coming home from work and doing this. What are good things to prepare in advance for an after-work gathering like that? You can just whip it out of the fridge and set it out.
Sure. Things like deviled eggs are really nice prepared ahead of time. A cheese board is pretty easy. You could, you know, pick up a few wedges of nice cheese and some good crackers and preserves on your way home, and then you just put it out on a board. I love putting out just bowls of fruit or cherry tomatoes. People like to grab those and then munch on them, or maybe some nice dips, you know, a hummus or a pesto dip or something like that is easy to put out with a crudité as well.
You know, I really like eating deviled eggs. I think I've confessed on the show before. I think of them as a really hard thing to make. Michelle, our board operator here, is nodding. I may have just told her that I don't make deviled eggs. Can you talk us through the basics of making deviled eggs, Anna?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, you just boil the eggs, kind of a hard-boiled egg, and the trick is getting them to peel and look nice. And the trick I have found, especially since I have backyard chickens, so my eggs are uber fresh and really hard to peel, is I steam them instead of boiling them. I steam them over boiling water for 11 or 12 minutes, and then they peel really nicely. And then you slice them in half, you put the yolks into a bowl, mash it up with whatever your other ingredients are, a little mayo or paprika or something fun like curry and some herbs, and then you either spoon or squeeze it back into the centers of the egg.
That's easy enough. I could probably do that. And this is new to me, steaming eggs, and that's easier to peel?
Yeah, that's my find.
Can you do that with Easter eggs?
Yeah.
That would work.
Yep.
Okay. All right. I've learned many things already. We are talking about entertaining outside in the summertime with Anna Thomas Bates. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Talking about the food, and we're talking about the socializing and the fun as well. Do you have, like Anna used to anyway, a regular weekly event where you have people over in the summer, maybe the spring and fall too, and eat outside? What are your go-to recipes for a picnic, a barbecue, that outside potluck, the meetup at the park after the kids' soccer game? What do you bring? What do you serve? What do you love to eat? What do you avoid? And to grill or not to grill when you're entertaining outdoors? And what do you put on the grill? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Find a link to that recipe for the berry bars Anna was talking about earlier. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Maybe get your advice, maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. Stick around. More coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our Food Friday conversation now about entertaining outdoors and what to cook, what to serve, what to eat at your outdoor gathering. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. On the food side of things, what are some of your favorite recipes for that picnic, that outdoor potluck, that meal on the back patio or the back porch? And on the fun side, do you do this? Do you have people over to eat outside at your place a lot or at the local park? Or is it something you mean to do, but something holds you back? What is that something that holds you back? Maybe Anna can talk you past that. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We have Anna Thomas Bates with us, food writer. Her website is Tallgrass Kitchen. She writes a lot for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We'll go to our callers now with Matt in Oxford. Matt, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you have for us, Matt?
Well, I like to, when I'm entertaining, I like to make pizza in the backyard.
And you do that on the grill?
You can do it on the grill, or you can build your own cob oven, which is what I kind of graduated into.
You said a cob oven?
Yeah, so you use clay and fire brick, and you mix the clay with sand and hay as you build a dome. And you can get plans online, and it costs a little bit of money to do that, but you can get that oven up to about 700 degrees.
Wow.
Pizza in about 2 minutes.
Matt, that's you're hardcore with this backyard pizza baking. What are some of your favorite topping combos that you've made in your either on the grill or in this oven?
I love kimchi on pizza. I like fruit such as pear and cantaloupe. And I like egg on pizza.
And I got to ask, Matt, when is your restaurant opening up?
about 2 months ago.
Oh, you do? You actually do have a restaurant? Okay.
I do, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Matt, so much for calling in. So, Matt, Anna, sounds like he's pretty serious about this. You also mentioned pizza on the grill. Do you have any tips? I wouldn't really know. You're making your own crust, I'm assuming. Do you have to pre-bake it a little bit so it doesn't just glop onto the grill?
No. If you have kind of a little sturdier pizza crust, and I think Cook's Illustrated has a good grilling pizza crust recipe, you just keep them small. They're kind of single-person size pizzas, and you throw it on a screaming hot grill right on the racks and let that side that's face down get kind of golden brown. Then you flip it over, and you're using real, you know, fresh, not toppings that have to cook a lot. Mm-hmm. You scatter a few toppings on top, close the grill for just a couple minutes while the other side cooks and those toppings get warm, and then you just take it off with a big spatula and you're good to go.
That sounds fantastic. Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Heidi on the line in Wausau. Heidi, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Excellent.
So what are you serving outside these days?
Oh, man, well, we always make this. Every 2 years we go to Mexico and we bring back fresh fish. And our favorite item to have on the grill is fresh fish. We like a firmer fish. And this year we had marlin and we had Dorado, and my husband cuts up into small steaks, lightly puts a breading on it with some seasoning, and you can spice it up with Cajun seasoning. We have garlic butter, and we serve it rare to medium rare, and everybody brings over a salad or dessert, and it turns into a great big party. And
wow.
Have anybody complain, and nothing beats a fresh fish on a grill.
Heidi, I got to ask, are you and your husband going to Mexico and catching these marlin and other fish?
Yes, we do. We've done that twice, and we've come back with marlin and Dorado, and we've come back with yellowtail, and it is a wonderful, down at the Baja, very inexpensive. And all the fish you can catch, it's unbelievable. This year we caught 3 marlin. We did get a smaller one. Mine was 100. And 2 years ago, we caught a large one at 165 pounds.
Oh, just that little guy at 100 pounds. Heidi, thank you so much for that call. Before, Anna, I ask you about making fish for these outdoor gatherings, I will invite callers who do things simply to call and help me out. We've had callers making their own grills for their pizza and going to Mexico to catch their fish. I need a little low-effort way as we talk to Anna Thomas-Bates. So if you have simple suggestions for outdoor entertaining, call in at 800-642-1234. But Anna, that marlin, that fresh-caught marlin sounds great. Any advice for cooking with fish or other seafood for our outdoor gathering?
You know, I'm always a little nervous I'm going to overcook things.
Oh, me too.
I'm sure other people have that same feeling. And a nice way to do it, not on the grill, actually. In the oven, I like to do it in a parchment packet, but that really wouldn't work on the grill. But on the grill, you could use foil. So that way, it's kind of steaming itself inside, and it's going to stay nice and moist. So you're not going to get that same grilled flavor. So with a firmer fish, I would go right on the racks. But for something more delicate or for you're a little nervous, using that foil packet to kind of steam it and cook it a little bit more gently and softly is a good way to go.
Yeah, I've grilled catfish for me, and that seems to hold up pretty well right on the grill. But I've done, I think, a halibut for my wife, and that's so, I think it's like flaky. You got to put that in tinfoil or you're just feeding it right into the charcoal.
Yeah, and you can add lemon and herbs right in with that packet and even some vegetables, and it all cooks at once, and it's really easy.
Go to our next caller. Jack is with us in Balsam Lake. Jack, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you like to serve outside?
Well, I'll tell you what, I got a thing that I like to serve, and we do it several times a summer, and it's called beer can bacon wrap burgers.
Wow.
And almost everybody loves to get into the making of it, so I don't have to do it all. And basically, you can get this recipe online if you go to, I'll think of it before I'm done here. Oh, Pit Boys, beer can bacon wrap burgers, and
okay,
they did the whole recipe. But you chop up some colorful bell peppers, like some yellow, red, and orange, and then chop up some onions and throw them in there and add a little bit of barbecue sauce to that. And then you take some hamburger and you roll it into a ball that's about the size of a baseball, about 2 inches in diameter, then grab a cold beer can out of the fridge. It's got to be cold, and push it down on top of the ball, and then you take your two hands and you start forming the burger, the hamburger, all the way around the beer can, and you tell you run it up about halfway up the can. Then you pull the can out of there, and you throw the mixture that you came up with in the middle and add some barbecue sauce on top of that, and add a little bit of your favorite cheese, and then wrap two strips of bacon around that ball and throw it on the grill. And everybody likes making their own, and you cook it for, oh, I don't know, about an hour and a quarter, hour and a half on the indirect heat side.
Indirect, okay.
And the next thing you know, you got stuff that everybody made themselves. They've never had it before, and they absolutely love it. And serve it with pickles and chips and whatever they want to drink, and you got yourself a heck of a party.
Jack, that sounds like a lot of fun and delicious, and all those peppers. It's basically health food, Anna.
Yeah, exactly. And you get to drink the beer afterwards, I'm assuming.
Yeah, maybe wash off that beer can first. Jack, thank you so much for sharing that. We'll go next to Pat with us in Minneapolis. Pat, hi.
How are you doing today?
Good. What are you serving us tonight, Pat?
Well, it's not serving. You wanted something simple. We have what's called Friday Night Bites. When the recession hit, we just invited over the neighbors on a Wednesday if Friday night was going to look decent. They bring their own stuff to grill on our grills, a dish to pass. They bring their own booze, beer, and we provide the utensils and the ice, and that's it.
Pat, thank you so much. That sounds great. And Anna, that's what you were saying earlier. It can be really, really simple.
Yeah, it's a great idea. And I love the idea of having something that occurs regularly, you know, weekly or biweekly or monthly. Then it's on the calendar and people just are counting on it.
All right, Pat, thanks so much. We'll try to drop by. I don't think I can make it tonight, but maybe next week. Bruce is with us next in Clinton. Bruce, hi.
Good morning. Occasionally, I will make homemade pizza in the Dutch oven with charcoal briquettes top and bottom.
Mm. Oh, top and bottom. Okay, so does that gets a little crispy on the top, maybe?
It cooks better. Well, I have 2/3 of the briquettes on the top, so it cooks from the top down.
Okay.
And I just buy a canned pizza dough and traditional toppings, and we go from there. But I also make bread, pies, cobblers, stews, and your traditional stuff all over open wood.
Well, that sounds great, Bruce. Thanks so much for sharing that. The baking outside sounds like a lot of fun, Anna.
I do. I have fond memories of summer camp and doing cobblers right in the coals, and there's nothing quite the same.
Well, do you have plans this weekend, Anna? Later this summer, are you going to be hosting outdoor stuff, and what's going to be on the menu?
You know, I just had a huge milestone birthday, and it was all outside, and we did it up. I actually had a mobile bar called the Barmadillo came out, a 1957 refurbished Airstream, and they served cocktails, and I had a taco bar, and I had a beautiful cheese board, and I had a bluegrass band, and this is obviously a lot more effort than you have to go to, but it was a magical night. The music was great, the stars were out, the fireflies were out, and I had 50 great friends over, and we just had a really, really good time.
Well, it sounds like a great 25th birthday celebration, Anna.
How did you know, Rob?
We've mentioned beer, and you just mentioned cocktails. What's a favorite summer cocktail to serve outside?
Well, you know, I like something that is kind of low alcohol, so something that has bubbles, like a Collins. So you could do some strawberries, smash it with some syrup and some sugar, simple syrup and some basil, add some gin, and then top it off with either like a cava or prosecco or just seltzer. And it's light and, you know, a little bit boozy, and it has some seasonal fruit in it, and really easy.
That sounds really summery. Well, Anna, thanks a lot for joining us. Always a lot of fun to talk to you.
Thank you. Have a great summer.
We've been talking to Anna Thomas Bates. She's a food writer. Check out her website. It's called Tall Grass Kitchen, and she also is a contributor, regular contributor over at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us on this Food Friday to talk about entertaining outdoors in the summer. Still time to hear from you over at the Central Time Facebook page. Love to hear your suggestions. I got to say, I'm inspired. I think I need to do this. Try to break my reclusive spirit a little bit, have some people over and serve things up. So I'd love to see your suggestions and also just tell us how you do it. If you've got one of these regular, I don't know, maybe Friday night gigs where you have people over for entertaining. Again, share your recipe ideas, your serving suggestions, and your social outdoor summer habits, and find a link to that recipe for three berry pie bars, I think they're called. Find it all on the Central Time Facebook page. Here's a news item with a personal connection for me. It's a story about drones and candy and ferrets. The black-footed ferret in the Great Plains region of this country is on the verge of extinction, has been for a long time, in large part because of a plague that affects the ferret and its main food source, the prairie dog. So that's the bad news, has been bad for some time. Good news, maybe a new high-tech plan. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is going to try to use drones to drop candy. I think it's M&Ms, but they've put in it a vaccine for the plague. The candy is going to alert not the ferrets themselves, but the prairie dogs. They're going to time it when the prairie dogs are awake. The other guys who would eat it aren't. So they're going to drop this vaccinated candy, M&Ms, for the prairie dogs to eat, and then hopefully they'll have a resistance to this plague. They'll be immunized against it. So then more healthy prairie dogs for the black-footed ferrets to eat and fewer infected prairie dogs who are going to give the disease to the ferrets. As a fellow ferret myself, best of luck to the prairie dogs, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the black-footed ferret itself. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.